Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. July is a month celebrated as the birthday of the United States of America. In 2018, Yankee Doodle has 12 score and two feathers in its cap, and its founding principles of liberty and justice for all are enshrined above all other maxims. The persistent conundrum is that the actuality has always been dreadfully less than its spirited promise, that neither liberty nor justice is the daily reality for millions of Americans who are governed instead as though they live in a police state because they are poor or are of a minority race, and now, especially if they are immigrants or refugees seeking liberty or justice. The old evils of worth measured by wealth, gender, and race continually and perversely undercut the original intent of the nation claims to eulogize, which knocks asunder the third leg of the credo, equality. If the American Revolution is accepted as more than a revolt of colonial bourgeoisie, and if it gave birth to a plausibly egalitarian society in which the common citizenry had a chance to be their own rulers, it should also be realized that every progressive reform has been bitterly and often bloodily resisted and only adopted into law with extreme reluctance. And reforms that have been ratified are generally countered with vicious backlash and unrelenting reversion. Our ancestors who wrote the Constitution knew very well that governments swallow the rights of their citizenries, and that the natural inclination of authority is to consolidate and perpetuate its power by any means. Reflexively, government subverts the rights of all but its ruling classes, even if the system originated to provide rights to the governed. The laws of the Constitution simply make it more difficult for the leaders of government to make the rest of us so completely their subjects. A sort of monarchical trinity that was designed to be a separation of powers has devolved instead to consolidate all power at the top, which dictates the political, social, and private lives of the rest of us. While we commemorate the development of political rights and liberties over the centuries through display and ceremonies around such documents as the Magna Carta, which gave rights to barons against kings in June 1215, and this month's 242nd anniversary of the American Declaration of Independence in 1776, and Bastille Day this Saturday, July 14th, the advent of the French Revolution in 1789, as well as dual celebration in December of the Bill of Rights of 1791 and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, both of which attest to the rights of common people, and in particular protect minorities from the tyranny of majorities, we are witness to the deliberate reversal of human rights and civil liberties through the startlingly rapid rise of despotism throughout the world, expressly marked by the incongruous and brazenly vulgar ascent to power of Donald Trump. Almost overnight, old coarse fascism in modern populist disguise triumphed, and domestic politics in the USA have become as clamorously vile and confrontational as during the lead-up to the Civil War a century and a half ago. Complex social and political problems have reverted to an us or them snarl. Vengeful fables of racial intolerance and floggingly venal perceptions of democracy disrupt and undermine majority rule with misanthropic revulsion for anyone considered to be other. White supremacists and neo-fascists are easily incited to ethnically cleanse abnormal Americans from the homeland. The contrived laceration of deep inferiority animosities of marginalized misogynists to react with fear and loathing as true Americans to eradicate untrue or impure Americans, and to lock out or lock up and deport foreign intruders and trespassers who are generally poor and non-Caucasian from bunghole countries. A devastating reversal of the USA as a welcoming melting pot and refuge for the world's impoverished and dispossessed, which has, of course, been more perception than actuality. The current xenophobic obsession with virulent nationalism by our narcissistic neo-fascist president and his subterranean Morlocks displays inequities and rot within the nation, while simultaneously promotes the avaricious corruptions of a powerful and elitist minority whose ideological fictions attempt to justify tyrannies and terrorisms, small and large. These newly reconstructed Federalists share a rigidly constrained interpretation of the Constitution, which from the very beginning of the Republic has insisted that its rights and privileges belong to the wealthy and propertied elite, its duties and obligations to everyone else. They would wish to suspend the Bill of Rights and believe what they call original intent of the Constitution should be its only interpretation. It is an absurd and dangerous notion, comparable to religion in its implication that all progress of intellect and human rights ended at the Constitution's origins. The actual intent of the Constitution's authors was to make its concepts of liberty and justice as broad and flexible through amendment to reflect future complexities and interpretations of freedom they were unable to anticipate or too contemporarily divided in opinion to immediately resolve, among them the large movements to emancipate slaves and women. As with fundamentalist Christianity and its perpetual censure of heretical liberalism, secular democratic governance attempts in every era to subvert evolutionary political progress and shift its constitutional mandate to rigidly right-wing dogma if it is not constantly re-infused with constitutional principles. And it should also be asserted that we have passionately and often violently squabbled from the start as to precisely what sort of nation and people we are and ought to be. But for all the argument, there should be no doubt that the people are sovereign. The people have basic and fundamental rights, whether any government or structure of power attempts to shrink or abolish them. And these basic rights are from birth without compromise. The right to think and speak openly of what anyone and everyone of us thinks, the freedom of association or of religion or to abstain from religion. These are, as the Declaration of Independence irrevocably states, inalienable rights, and the only true purpose of our democratic government is to secure, protect, and enlarge those rights. The Bill of Rights were added to the mainframe of the Constitution as its heart, and to give teeth to those inalienable rights, limiting government and countervailing majorities from denying or taking away the rights of minorities, no matter how unpopular or seemingly incompatible minority opinions or beliefs are. The Bill of Rights acts as America's Ten Commandments, which in turn manifests the USA as a nation of laws that guarantee its rights and freedoms that even a perverted redefinition of democracy by the current president and his nouveau Federalists cannot trump, despite their sinister attempts to seize total power. Yet complacency could prove fatal. Our inalienable rights demand inevitable obligations to defend or preserve them. The upsurge of nationalistic militarism is particularly ominous, not entirely for the threat of warmongering or probable use of nuclear weapons, but for the systematic obliteration of civil law and assumption of military rule, at present by a five-time draft dodger who shirked war duty in his youth, a preposterous fake who pompously claims the right to abolish democratic government for his own personal rule as dictator and generalissimo. Benjamin Franklin warned that such an impostor would camouflage his own oligarchical avarice in cloth of stars and stripes and a pestilence of lying deceit, which calls upon the irony that America celebrates its independence in the month named after Julius Caesar, who more or less terminated the Republic of ancient Rome. And that was something I wrote, which I call Birth of a Nation. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake, Strange Fruit. News traveled fast in 1939 after she debuted the song. Released as a single, the song eventually sold 1 million copies and became her signature song, even as most radio stations in America refused to play it. The song was Strange Fruit, and the singer was Billie Holiday, considered one of the best jazz vocalists of all time. Billie referred to Strange Fruit as her personal protest against lynching and was often harassed for singing it. Close friends said that singing that song made her sick and upset after all she'd seen and experienced as a Black woman. Consider the lyrics. Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh, and the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for a tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter crop. Strange Fruit, written by Abel Meeropol, son of Jewish immigrants, proved to be a powerful example of protest art that helped galvanize the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, speaking to millions of Black and white Americans yearning for a more just civil society. Billie Holiday's haunting rendition conjured America's horrific legacy of lynching, where white mobs tortured and murdered at least 3,500 Black men, women, and children for a variety of supposed offenses, including insulting, and that's a quote, whites, interracial sex, and other generally unproven crimes. Whole families came to witness lynchings, and merriment, food, whiskey, and flags abounded. Typifying the grotesque excess of spectacle lynching was the lynching of 17-year-old African-American farmhand Jesse Washington in Waco, Texas, on May 15, 1916. After a jury deliberated just 4 minutes, a mob dragged Washington from his cell and hanged him before 10,000 people on the grounds of City Hall, as the mayor and chief of police watched from a window above. That kind of festivity obscured the sinister murder and dulled the ritual's true function, reestablishing and maintaining the power of whites over blacks in post-slavery America. The ugliness of lynching, which persisted from Reconstruction through the mid-1960s and beyond, is difficult for white and Afro-Americans to face after decades of white silence and faded memories. But who can forget the brutal slaying of 14-year-old Emmett Till on August 28, 1955, in Money, Mississippi? At his Chicago funeral, his mother, Mamie Till, insisted that thousands of mourners view Emmett in an open casket. The Till murder was instrumental in advancing the plea for civil rights for Black Americans. Lynching is the execution, most often by hanging, of a man, woman, or child by a lawless crowd or mob without due process. Black Americans were sometimes burned alive, shot, drowned, beaten, or otherwise murdered by white mobs. The number of lynchings in America varies, depending on the time frame and source of lynching reports. But according to NAACP records, there were 4,743 lynchings in the United States between 1882 and 1968, with 73% involving Black Americans. Some 1,297 white people, 27%, were lynched for helping Blacks, opposing lynching, or for domestic crimes like cattle rustling. According to Richard M. Perloff, professor of communication at Cleveland State University, there are four principal characteristics of lynching: a hatred of blacks, victims innocent of any crime, law enforcement looking the other way, and making an example of the alleged violator. An estimated 79% of lynchings happened in the South, led by Mississippi with 581 lynchings. Most lynchings that occurred in the West were of whites accused of murder or cattle theft. Race riots broke out in 1919 in 26 cities, including Chicago and Washington, D.C. White mobs lynched at least 76 African Americans, 12 of them U.S. soldiers. Lynching did not end in 1968, as statistics may imply. In The Last Lynching, a one-hour special on race in America, aired on October 13, 2008, veteran broadcast journalist Ted Koppel focused on a 1981 lynching of 19-year-old Michael Donald in Mobile, Alabama, by two members of the Ku Klux Klan. Koppel claimed that, quote, "Lynchings are a form of terrorism, and the particular purpose was to say to Afro-Americans that you will never vote or be part of the political process in this country. And if you think you will move in that direction, there will be terrible consequences." And that was Ted Koppel. African-American James Byrd was murdered by three white men in Jasper, Texas, on June 7, 1998. One perpetrator was executed, another sentenced to execution, and the other received a life sentence. So there was some justice of sorts, subsequent to one of the most vicious racial crimes in American history. Just 1 year later, on October 6, 1999, a gay 19-year-old white man, Matthew Shepard, was brutally murdered in Laramie, Wyoming. Shepard stood just 5 feet, 2 inches tall. There have been belated and somewhat reluctant efforts to acknowledge and apologize for the killing of thousands of innocent Americans. After noting that nearly 200 anti-lynching bills have been introduced and defeated in Congress during the first half of the 20th century, the U.S. Senate on June 13, 2005, finally approved a resolution apologizing for its failure to enact federal anti-lynching legislation. That was the first time the Senate had apologized, after numerous Senate filibusters blocked legislation three times in the 20th century, and there was no roll call, only a voice vote from the few senators on the floor. After the August 9, 2017 protest in Charlottesville, Virginia, President Donald Trump issued remarks that appeared to condone the activities of white supremacists. Trump continues to advocate violence directed at minorities and women. But there remains hope. The Legacy Museum and National Memorial for Peace and Justice, dedicated to the victims of white supremacy, opened on April 26 this year. The six-acre site details the harrowing magnitude of lynchings and provides a jarring expression of confidence in the possibility of change. Yet it remains evident that American history is heavy with racism. It's immediate, it's everywhere, it's visible, it's violent, and it's dramatic. Sadly, many Americans take lightly the horror and injustice of lynchings, as did an Oakhurst, California high school principal who allowed two teenagers wearing Ku Klux Klan costumes to pretend to lynch another boy wearing blackface at a Halloween party on October 31st, 1933. Pathetic. Ida B. Wells, an African-American journalist and activist who led an anti-lynching crusade in the 1890s, concluded, "Our country's national crime is lynching. It is not the creature of an hour, the sudden outburst of uncontrolled fury, or the unspeakable brutality of an insane mob." And that was Ida Wells. While we have acknowledged our culpability, we need to do more to promote equal justice for all. We need to heed the advice of Abraham Lincoln, who in his 1861 inaugural address urged Americans to be imbued by the better angels of our nature. Sherilyn A. Eiffel, author of On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, has proposed a number of local reparation initiatives. She suggests public apologies, expunging the records of or issuing pardons to Black lynching victims accused of or convicted of crimes they did not commit. In addition, Eiffel suggests the creation of monuments or commemorative public spaces in the community, placing gravestones on unmarked burial sites of lynching victims, mandatory school programs on the local history of lynching, reopening criminal investigations into lynchings, financial compensation for lynching victims' descendants, and for those whose family homes or businesses were destroyed in the aftermath of lynching, an institutional reform focused on the legal system and the media. A tall order, indeed. But it seems clear that we have the opportunity to confront 20th century racial violence and begin a long overdue process of truth-telling and reconciliation. Addressing a Cornell University graduating class on October 15, 1962, Martin Luther King Jr. quipped, "It may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can stop him from lynching me." And I think that's pretty important. And that was Strange Fruit by Dr. Robert Brake, who lives in Ocean Park, Washington. He is a frequent contributor to this program and writes for the Chinook Observer. Last month, three Black U.S. senators introduced yet another bill to make lynching a federal hate crime. They were Cory Booker of New Jersey, Kamala Harris of California, and Tim Scott of South Carolina. They are the only three Black U.S. senators. And this is Michael McCusker. I believe the public officials who are responsible for the egregious and toxic political situation in the USA should be personally confronted nonviolently wherever they might publicly appear. There is a fine line between the people and the mob, to be sure. But it is the people's right to sometimes be a vocally nonviolent, if not particularly decorous, mob. The president has, after all, essentially declared the people as enemies of the state. Saturday is Bastille Day 229. Viva la liberty, equality, fraternity.